Hello, Bill. I should say that next door seems to be the day for the gardener. The blower
Oh,
is
good timing.
good timing. The blower has been going constantly. I've shut whatever windows and louvers, but I can't really switch off the audio, which I would do in a larger meeting.
That's fine. I can edit that out when we get the clips. And I can't hear it
What
on
is
my end.
No, he's not.
What
He's
is it?
not.
A
He's
whippersnapper.
not waving the blower at the moment. Of course, the most wonderful
Ah.
implement for annoying neighbours.
How are you
What
doing,
is it? A
Brenda?
whippersnapper?
Of course, of course. You realise it can take the
Leaf
place of a
blower.
vacuum cleaner.
It's just a classic, isn't it?
Margaret, could you? Is there any way you could get a little bit more light on your face?
Light on my face? Yes,
Yeah.
I can do that by opening. I just shut some iron windows shutters to keep the noise out.
Just
This
a
is
little bit.
okay,
You,
so
we
I'll
can
get
see,
that open.
I can see you okay, but
now tell me about the trout fishing.
oh well, we didn't get trout fishing as it turned out. I sort of injured myself in a
Is that better?
that's much better, Margaret. Thanks.
Yeah.
I injured myself in a agricultural way with my own whippersnapper. I sort of fell down
There's the
and got
blower
a
now. I think it's the blower as well as the whippersnappers.
blower, right?
Oh, so
So I
Quinton's
just had to
away.
have a
Sorry, go, Quinton. Can,
six days
Quinton, can you
relaxing.
turn your sound up a bit, or does he think it's mine? I mean, I can hear Bill clearly. I just...
Can you adjust that, Bill?
It's
How's that?
okay on my end. How's that now, Margaret, for you?
Hello, 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm talking to Margaret White.
I
It's
can't hear
me.
too well, I'm sorry to say. I did have those blinds shut because they're metal and I thought it reduced the sound a bit. Never mind. There's not much I
How's
can.
that? If I project a little bit, Margaret, hey?
That's better. Yeah,
One,
thank
two,
you.
three, four. Okay.
No, I'm just
I'll
going to. Do you two know each other? Do I need to introduce you? Do you two know each other from Queensland World or?
No,
We've
I
been
don't
on a
think so.
webinar together. Yes.
Yes, we yes. I asked you a nasty question.
Quentin's
Yes, but
that's your
roving
job.
rap, roving.
Which you
answer?
Quentin fulfills the role of roving raconteur or roving raconteur. I'm not quite sure, but he kindly volunteers, and he's currently in Tassie. So he's done interviews for us in Sydney, Melbourne, and now Tasmania. So we're hitting three states.
I hope you're building up the content pretty well, Bill,
We're
on
going
your
well,
communication
yeah.
strategy.
Bill and Quentin, could we just pause for the minute? I'm going to see if I can get some headphones that might help. Would you mind
Yeah,
if I did that?
go.
Thank
We've
you.
got plenty of time,
Off
Margaret.
you
Take, that's why we have the hour set up. Yeah, the content's going well. It's interesting. It's because we've got your stream, we've got the the political streams. We had Dreyfus as one posted last week. And
Well, how did
Barker's
that
not
go? I
it's
missed that one.
good. Barker's not quite as interrogatory as he could be. So he gives them a lot of leeway. But he got him a couple of good spots where, talking about whistleblower protection and why he hasn't done much. And, but he didn't get into the knack at all. It was a bit, it was anyway. But it's fascinating. A sign of how nerdy our audience is. Can you have a guess of the which podcast has been most popular of the ones that we've done?
Watson or Wheely.
Watson, and then the Clerk of the Victorian Parliament was the second most interesting podcast for our audience.
Is that right?
Yeah, so we're still, I think the challenge is to get into the new audience because that's clearly the Centre for Public Integrity existing audience rather than anyone that's
Yeah.
new or novel. So that's the challenge. We're going to keep pumping it. I think the other challenge in, reflecting on it is we're doing too many. We're doing three a week. And it's just too much
Yeah.
content for people to get across. But it's
But
good.
it's searchable.
It's searchable, it's a repository, it's there. Like these ones I think are excellent. I love these ones of the directors. And these will be,
On. I was trying to
good
get
for a
on.
few years.
Yeah, it's what we say. It's in the ether.
Yeah. And it's getting great responses. People love it. You know, when you're getting emails saying, I spent the whole weekend gardening going through each podcast. And,
is that right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's, I suppose, in a digital revolution terms, it's getting your voice there. And so that a voice has to be heard. And that's what I found.
And I think a lot of people like long form, you know, snippets of articles and social media is one format people enjoy. But then I think a lot of people really enjoy just sitting and listening or doing something and listening to interesting people talk about their subject matter.
Yeah.
How bad was your damage from the whippersnapper, mate?
Oh, it's okay. It was sort of a little bit of, quite extensive bruising in my leg, but so I was limping around for a while. But it's about 2 weeks now, and I'm getting better every day. So,
will you get to go? That was I saw that in your diary. That's what you're planning on doing is going fishing. Is there still a chance or not?
Yeah, we had to change. We didn't go up to the Central Highlands of Tasmania. We went somewhere up the coast. So that was lovely. We're on the coast here, but our house was booked out for those 6 days. So,
so you have to get out anyway. Yeah,
we just escaped to the trout grounds.
And when do you head overseas?
On the 1st of May, just before the election.
I was going to say, yeah, you just that poorly timed, or well timed.
Yeah. I see Jeffrey's going to a Friends of the ABC rally on.
Testing, testing, testing.
Got you there, Margaret. Yep, that sounds good.
Can I hear you?
How's that sound, Margaret?
Well, it's not too bad. I hope that works. Can you hear that?
All right. Well, look, sing out if you're struggling, and Bill can edit.
Yeah, I can edit.
I can repeat the question.
Yes, thank you. That sort of is a bit of a bore to have to do that, but the gardeners are going hell for leather. So,
I guess on our end, Margaret, it's actually not too bad. Like, we can hear you really well, and Quentin's is pretty
thanks.
Even.
Yeah, thanks, Don.
So I guess
thanks, Bill. Yes, I can. It's just that I'm struggling when the whippersnapper and the blower are going.
Yeah, so if through the interview, feel free just to pause, take your time when you're answering it, or just ask Quentin to repeat it, and I can edit that out if it doesn't flow well. But it's if you can't quite hear it, just say, Quentin, sorry, I just couldn't quite hear that. Could you repeat the question? And
righto. Look, I'm sorry. Totally unanticipated. I don't usually have to have earphones. It's a quiet domestic site in a study.
I've done quite a few of these. We always have a little bit of extra time just in case something like this occurs. It's good.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Quentin, for your patience.
Not at all.
I sound a bit like Qantas, don't I?
What, now,
thank you for your patience.
Your call is important to us.
That's right. Did you have any questions or things you wanted to clarify, Quentin or Margaret, before you get into it? Was there anything you...
Oh, could you just tell me how much time have you set aside for this, Bill?
Usually, 30 minutes.
30 minutes?
Yeah.
When I was reviewing my early life, not having thought about it for a long time, I suddenly got so excited about it all.
I know. it's hard
to
like
be nearly 82. There's a lot of years there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But look, it can be up to 40 or 50. Like trying to stop Quentin and Jeffrey was hard work. And then Quentin and Anthony went for nearly 50 minutes. And I was like, hang on, guys, you're going too far here. But it's good. It's really good. Like the three of you have led such interesting lives and done such interesting things. It's a good conversation. That's the hope, is that this gives a snapshot gives the audience a snapshot into who the key people at the center are and what they've done to get to this point. So what I'll do is I'm going to hide my visual. So I'll take my video away. I'll turn my microphone off so you won't hear me or catch any of my background noise. You two can chat and do whatever you want. And then when Quentin's ready to go, he'll do a 3, 2, 1. Welcome, I'm Dempster, journalist, and off he go. And then when you're ready, yell out and I'll jump back in and say good day again.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, Margaret, I'm going to follow the brief that Bill has provided.
Yep.
But it's to get from you your formative experiences, and I've got prompts there for the constitutional landmark cases, and as everything is laid out in a timeline, and then that'll get us up to your work for the centre, and what's motivated you to become involved.
Okay.
All right, guys. I'll see you later. I'll get out of the way.
Right, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Okay, you ready to go?
Yep.
Hello, everyone. This is a podcast for the Centre for Public Integrity, Australia's leading think tank on making our mighty nation accountable and a functioning democracy. We're up against some formidable authoritarian forces, so it's all shoulders to the democracy wheel. We're very fortunate today to have with us the great honour of talking to the Honourable Margaret White, AO. Margaret has a... hello, Margaret.
Hello, Quentin.
Margaret, you have a truly impressive CV in academia and the law. You're a former Supreme Court judge and Royal Commissioner. You've been involved in landmark constitutional cases as a barrister. You're a commander in the Royal Australian Navy and Deputy Chancellor of a former Deputy Chancellor of the University of Queensland. Now you're an advocate for the anti-corruption cause as a director for the Centre for Public Integrity. I'm trying to establish why and how you're motivated to do this work at this stage of your life and career. You have three adult children, and that's a very rich life and professional experience. Please tell us how it all started, where, and family and growing up.
Well, although I was born in Hamilton in Victoria, and I always like to mention that when I'm in Victoria, because that gives one a lot of standing, it was a wartime accident, and I was educated and grew up in South Australia. And I know that on the eastern seaboard, you like to mock South Australia, but in fact, it was a very rich background in which to grow up, because it gave the first suffrage for women. The local papers of the time, when the women came out to vote, and it was universal, it wasn't just unmarried women, as you remember in other places, and the nuns came out of their convents, that was particularly mentioned to vote, that it was like a great festival day. I think it was also the nonconformist religion, although I was a Catholic and I went 12 years to a Dominican convert. Nonetheless, the foundations of the state were by non-conformist Protestants, those who wouldn't sign the 39 Articles in the UK. They knew that because of that prejudice, they would never get on. And so they were really interested to come to South Australia. So it was pretty interesting. And of course, I was at university during the time of the rise of Don Dunstan. And it was a group of businessmen who founded the first Adelaide Festival of Arts, so they founded the University of Adelaide by their own subscriptions and so on. So it was a good background, I think. One felt very comfortable there. I did start medicine.
Was there any lawyers in the family?
None at all. Both my parents were school teachers. And politics was meat and drink in our family of the socialist kind.
Right. You mentioned medicine.
Oh, I thought I was going to do medicine because I matriculated for medicine. But I realised I'd reached the apogee of my mathematical capacity. And it really wasn't going to be a successful university career. So after a couple of weeks, I changed to law. I wasn't very interested in law, but my father said, well, give it a go. I didn't regret
law,
that I'd
law
done
is a hard Law is a hard slog, isn't it?
Compared to medicine, a breeze. Absolutely a breeze. Yeah.
But why I say that is because all my lawyer friends say they agonised over the detail that they had to be across.
That's true. But look, what about all those chemical formulae that you had to learn? Goodness. I found science quite difficult because of that memory stuff, whereas there's a lot of seat of the pants stuff in the law.
And so you graduated, and then you went into academia. You started to teach law.
Well, there was a bit of an interregnum, Quentin, and that, of course, was probably a fundamental formative period in my life. I became research assistant to Professor D.P. O'Connell in the University of Adelaide, along with a couple of other people. He had a Ford Foundation grant from the United States to investigate the effect of independence on treaty commitments by colonial countries, countries that had been largely in the British Empire, but also in the others. This may sound a little arcane and strange, but you think about it. If you're not a member of the Universal Postal Union, which is not a UN body, you can't post a letter internationally. There's no way of doing it. Visa abolition agreements, really important for tourism. The United Kingdom extended its visa abolition agreements, which were bilateral, to all of its colonies pretty well. So people who lived in, I'll give the example because I have some practical understanding of it, in Barbados, for example, in the Caribbean, could go to France, go back to Barbados, no visas needed. The day of independence, that was all over. And some of them were stranded at Orly Airport and so on. So the reality of public international law and its whole network of treaties became terrifically interesting to me. And that really was the core of my legal training and work from then on. So I went to the West Indies where I worked and on this project. And it was such an eye-opener for a young person. I was about 21. 21, 22, because I was suddenly exposed to this much bigger world. The Prime Minister of Barbados, when I went to see him, and it's a very small country, 11 miles by 14, he had been a Battle of Britain pilot in the Air Force. He was a Barbadian, as they call them. They had got their independence the year before. And he'd done many sort. He just left Barbados and went and signed up in the Air Force. Anyway, he said to me, using a very raffish kind of voice, but he was black as night. He said, "Oh, I say, have you still got that frightfully silly chappy as Attorney General in Australia?" And I couldn't really think to whom he was referring for a while, and then I thought, "Do you mean Mr. Snedden?" "That's him, that's him." And I was then attacked about the mechanization in the sugar industry because Barbados relied then largely, he'd just become prime minister. But Australia was really taking the market away from them and so on. So I was really thrown in the deep end in challenging ways that I'd never experienced before. I loved those people. There was a joint project with Guyana, which was a much tougher environment because I don't expect anyone to remember, but Chetty Jagan was the communist chief minister of Guyana, which is just sort of on the top of South America. It used to be British Guiana. And it was thought that it wouldn't be a good idea for the Queen to give independence to a country that was led by a communist. So there was a sort of a coup, which I was told was MI6 at work. And Forbes Burnham became prime minister. He also was a lawyer. I could rabbit on forever about what an eye-opener it was to me to see this wider world. These were smart. A lot of those people in the West Indies were three generations University of London graduates. There was hardly an Australian that could boast of two. So
Higher educational standards, and then what did you do after your overseas experience?
well, then I came back and continued with this sort of international law project for the International Law Association I had in the meantime taken a commission in the Royal Australian Navy because they realised that our and that was tri-service then, it wasn't all one service. They'd realised that Australia wasn't promulgating the Red Cross conventions to its servicemen, which it was required to do. That's the 1949 conventions. And so they thought perhaps they'd better give some lectures to the final year cadets at the Naval College. So I was given a commission because Australia had just done Subic Bay, and Chief of the Navy said to me, "We don't want to pay you that much money because the lawyers are so expensive." So I became a second officer RANS on $6 and some cents a day pay. And I used to go every January and lecture to the final year cadets on the United Nations and generally the principles of the laws of war and international law generally. That was pretty boring for most of the lads because they were just keen to get to sea and to leave the college. They found it a little odd, but of course now it's, I think it's very important. And one or two of those students did go on to higher education in international law. They thought it was worthwhile. So then
Did you
I
get to see?
married and came to Queensland. That's a
And
big.
you didn't get to sea and then on to the University of Queensland.
Yes, I well, I when I got when I got married, my husband, who had been a submariner in the Navy, had decided he wanted an education. And so he was leaving the Navy to go to university to study law. So one of us had to earn a living. So I applied to the university and got a position there as senior tutor.
And what subjects? What's up? You just law. You just taught law.
I did. Yes, I the only other rather funny one was teaching law to engineering students. That was a bit amusing, very simplistic. Yes, I taught introduction to law to the first years, and I loved that to bits. I loved having the first year students. There were a lot of cynical members of staff, and I was pleased to have them with me first because I wasn't a bit cynical. And so international, then I taught international law for a short, I can't really remember now, a couple of years with John Kidd. I taught in the torts course and tutored in it, and I taught legal history with Chris Gilbert. So it was a across the board.
And then you moved, you seem to not be cynical from your earlier life experience and your overseas experiences. How is that so? Is that part of your childhood, your upbringing, your family upbringing? Because many people in the law do become cynical and hard, you know, very clearly cynical about the way systems operate.
That's true, but those people that I mixed with in the Caribbean and the terrific Canadians, because the Caribbean is a sphere of influence for Canada, and I just worshipped them because they gave me so much help. I went up to Toronto and saw their how they managed the treaty systems, which I was able, they were generous to bring back. They gave lots of educational scholarships. So there was so much goodness. And a lot of these politicians that I was working with, they were the ones that had brought their countries to independence against a pretty unattractive former colonial power. The UK had set them out onto their journey as independent countries without much, quite frankly, without much assistance at all. And another one of the research assistants was in Zambia, and I visited there. And again, that they were in the high points. A lot of these countries deteriorated, of course, in time with nepotism and corruption. But then it was so full of hope. It was wonderful. And you could see if you want those institutions to work and everyone's working towards that end, it is good. So I stayed with that.
And then after the University of Queensland, you became a practicing barrister and you're involved with some landmark constitutional cases. Just tell us briefly about that, Margaret.
Well, look, it's about luck in careers for me. I don't know other people, it's brilliance and hard slog, but I was just lucky because Professor O'Connell was by then at Oxford. And he was advising Joe Peterson on all those really weird constitutional adventures that he was interested in, like the Queen of Queensland and so on. So Professor O'Connell mentioned me to the Minister for Justice as a possibility if they were ever looking for anybody. And then my next door neighbour at our beach house happened to be a senior Crown solicitor, and he saw me as a good Catholic mother. He was sound. So
Down.
I'd just gone to the private bar, and I got a call to say, "Oh, Margaret, how would you like to go down to the High Court for us with David Jackson in the there's this case about a dam in Tasmania?" Queensland was intervening. Joe intervened in every case where there was any challenge to conservative principles, as you well know, Quentin.
I do.
So at that stage, I had not even signed the High Court roll of barristers, so I had to scramble and do that. You'll remember that that was a case where the Tasmanian government, which was a conservative government by this stage, wanted to have a hydroelectric dam damming the Gordon River, which was going to flood the whole of the Franklin River and all that southeast Queensland old forests, and it was opposed by constitutional groups. There was a and there, in the Commonwealth, it was a Labor government, and they were opposing this as well. And the Hydroelectric Commission was really an organ of the government, but it was sort of independent sufficiently. Anyway, it was an exciting case to be in as an intervener because we, I'm sorry to say, I intervened on the side of the people with black hats, not white hats, because that was for Queensland then. But it
Yep.
didn't matter. There were more people sitting at that bar table, 22, than since the bank nationalisation case in 1948.
Wow.
It was good to be there. And I'll tell you this thing, that there were only two women out of those 22 barristers, Mary Gaudron as Solicitor General for New South Wales, and myself as junior counsel for Queensland. And David Jackson was so thrilled. He said, "They're so rude about Queensland, but how many women are the others sending?" So
Yes.
that was a very important case, as you well know. And it was really whether the Commonwealth could validly prohibit the building of the dam under its World Heritage legislation, which it had brought in when the UNESCO listing of that area of Tasmania was listed on as a place of natural heritage to be preserved. So the Act gave effect to the convention that we were a member of. So the issues for the case really were the ambit of the external affairs power, whether in fact it was so expansive as to be able to really manage things that went on what were usually thought to be states' areas. And as you know, Quentin, there is forever that tension between Commonwealth and state rights and limits of power. It's all about power. The corporation's power was also introduced because of the Hydroelectric Authority. We have power over trading corporations. As you know, that's now been used by the Commonwealth to do all sorts of things. And I think the third point was acquisition on just terms, but that didn't go anywhere. And there was a glimmering of the nationhood power, an inherent power for the Commonwealth to be able to legislate about things that related to Australia as a country. That sort of didn't go anywhere in that case, but the interpretation of the external affairs power, I think, probably was thinking along those lines anyway, because it was really a notion of the external affairs power which allows Australia to take its place in the world community. So it was pretty exciting. Loved being there because we had no responsibility. We were interveners.
Yes. Tell us then about the Mabo case.
Well, the Mabo case was a case that had already been going for a little bit before I came into it, but the junior counsel had taken silk, and so they wanted a new junior. So I was brought into that one. And as you know, it began when the Jokie Peterson government were offering to all the former Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, missions, deeds of grant in trust, doggets, they were called, you might remember that expression. That really was a sort of community title, and that they'd have elections. Now, all the other Torres Strait Islanders and many of the mainland communities signed up to that. They thought that was a good deal. But Murray Island, Mur, better known nowadays as Mur, held out and refused to do that. People, Eddie Mabo was living and working in Townsville. The story's well known. He had Victorian public interest lawyers who were looking for a cause on this topic of the ownership of the land, and they found it in Eddie. So when it sort of started rolling along again, I was in it. But it shows the chance also of some big litigation. For example, the High Court was never going to decide the facts of that case, so they had to send it off to another court. So the first issue was whether it would be in the federal court or the state Supreme Court of Queensland. And Sir Harry Gibb, sitting as he was Chief Justice, sat as a single judge. We argued that because it was about land in Queensland and everything else was pretty equal between the federal court, the state Supreme Court, and the only reason why the feds would come into it was that the plaintiffs had joined the Commonwealth over the issue of land rights. That was all, sea rights, I beg your pardon. So he concluded that Queensland was the right jurisdiction, Supreme Court of Queensland. But I might say there was a little hint in the plaintiff's submissions that maybe the Supreme Court might be a little inclined to lean in favour of the state government, which was a very awkward submission to be making to Sir Harry Gipps, I think. Anyway, off it went to the Supreme Court of Queensland. Then, when it settled down, we had to get some trial dates. And I think you'll find this astonishing, but it was thought that it might take 6 weeks. That was the longest trial that they'd had ever. This is in 1980. Five. And so I went for the senior puny judge. And again, this is chancy. There were three judges available with a block of 6 weeks. There was Peter Connolly, there was Paul de Jersey, and there was Martin Moynihan. The plaintiffs objected to Paul de Jersey because he did so much crown work before he took an appointment to the court, which is a pretty outrageous thing, but frankly, to submit. But there it was. So sort of there was a bit of going on by the allocating judge, and finally he settled on Martin Moynihan. It was a great choice because he was passionately interested in the topic. He loved the witnesses. He was so enthusiastic. And I think that made the hearing go so much better. There it was. And of course, it's regarded, I think, as one of the great cases constitutionally. It was such an honour to be in it because everyone fell by the wayside. David Jackson went off to the federal court, and the Crown looked at me and said, "Well, look, even though you're not silk, you know so much about it, will you be the lead counsel?" And so I did that one for the hearing of the facts. And it was the most
And
important thing I've ever done.
is that right?
Yeah.
And it's helped to change our understanding of dispossession.
It has. It was, I think what's, I would have liked to have been on the side of the plaintiffs in that case, quite frankly,
Yeah.
Quentin. And I really yearned for it to be Pat Keane who was arguing, because Ron Caston, of course, everyone praises the late Ron Caston. He did wonderful work. His style wasn't my style. He was a bit more emotional about it all. He opened for 3 days. It's a long time. I'd sort of like to get on with it and perhaps pare it down a bit more. But of course, they won the day anyway in the end. But I think there was more nuance in it. You know, it was popular in Queensland to be terribly this well in what's the word? Critical of Pat Caloran, whose name would be well known to you. You probably knew him.
Yes.
Up in the Torres Strait, he was the protector up there. And he certainly wasn't seen as a racist by any means. I think he had lots of friends and family. You couldn't help but love those people. They were so interesting and fun. They reminded me of the West Indies people. But in any event, they left the Torres Strait Islands alone, really, to get on with their lives because they didn't have anything that the Queensland government or its businessmen wanted. There was a little effort by a fellow called Lyons to set up a fish factory on one of the three islands of the Murray Island group, but that didn't take off. He lived in Lennon's Hotel, I remember that.
Tell me, Margaret, just jumping ahead to the 2023 Voice campaign, what was your reaction when you saw the Australian public go from 60% support for constitutional recognition, which again would constitutionally have validated Mabo in the High Court? To see that go from 60% support to 60% negative.
Well, I was deeply disappointed, of course, because I felt that it was all based on false understanding of what was entailed in it. And I found that pretty challenging, that so determined were those people, not all of them, I suppose, not all of them, but so determined were many of them that it shouldn't happen for political reasons that were not actually deeply held reasons, and it was based on false premises about what the voice actually meant. I think probably that was a shocking experience for me. I couldn't believe it. That sense
Well,
of betrayal.
many people are still recovering from that in
That
the
they are, but
history.
it is interesting that there were many Aboriginals who thought that it wouldn't get up because they actually had a sense that things would go wrong. But yes, they are.
Yes. Back to you, Margaret. On the you accepted the judicial appointment. And that lasted for some years. Was that something you welcomed in your professional life? Because the life of a judge is pretty lonely, I'm told.
Well, I would have liked to have finished off Mabo. I took the appointment after Martin Moynihan had reserved his decision, which we'd come to the end of the trial over many years and vicissitudes, as you know. And of course, it was going for the law up to the High Court because this was only the trial of the facts. And I would like to have stayed the course on that, but it was a family decision. My husband said, one of us has got to have a pension. How cautious is that? And so I had been offered the district court, and I'd said no, because of family life, I couldn't go away into the provinces and leave the children. My husband was a barrister as well. So he said, oh, well, arrangements could be made so you didn't have to do circuit work. I was outraged. I said, certainly not. I either go in as an equal or I don't go in at all. Anyway, I was offered to masters and the masters stayed in Brisbane. So I had that rug cut from under my feet. 2 years as the master, then Don Horton committed suicide, which was a catalyst, I think, for the Labor government to decide there'd be no more masters. And so I was appointed to the trial division in 1992. So I had 2 years as a master of the court. It wasn't a bit lonely in any real sense because I was in court with dozens of barristers and solicitors every day. I'm naturally a bit of a busybody and curious. And so I found that jurisdiction really terrific. And my judicial colleagues, stunned as they were to have a nobody coming on the court with them, but were very pleasant. So that was fine. So I loved being a judge, Quentin. I really enjoyed it.
And writing judgments is a work of literature as well as logic. Were you skilled? Do you you're proud of your work in the writing of your judgments?
For a while, for many of the judgments, I was a bit slow. I found the rollover of the work a little constant. Some I thought were okay. Mostly, I realised that the litigants wanted a decision. They really didn't want literary works of art. I hope I improved as the years rolled past and got better at it. But I rarely called on Shakespeare or Milton to assist me in my reasoning process.
What about Latin?
Well, I did Latin as a student, and I still find that it can say in two or three words what we
Yes,
take many
yes.
others to say. An example in the Succession Act, for example, the expression per stirpes, which is the way in which an inheritance can occur. That is, it goes down through the stripes, through the son to the children to the children, and so on, per stirpes. It took 16 words in the Succession Act to explain that. So.
Well, that's engaging and fascinating.
But not to the point.
Look, let's move on. After you retired from, how long were you a judge for?
20 odd years.
20 odd years,
Yeah.
and you moved on. But tell us, there's other things I've got to get to, and that is your Royal Commission. You're appointed to two substantial royal commissions in our country's history. Just take us through that, Margaret.
The first one, I was asked before I retired, but as you know, we have statutory senility. In
Yes.
Australia. So in Queensland, you have no doubt that you're going to retire when you're 70 because you have no option. So just before that happened, the attorney of the day in the Campbell Newman government asked me if I would do, there'd been a lot of talk in the press about it, a review into the racing industry and its governance. The new government thought that there'd been some dirty work at the crossroads about money for race course improvements in various marginal seats, and they were looking for that kind of an outcome, which they didn't get. So I said, I know nothing about racing at all. And so the attorney said, well, that's why I'm asking you, because everyone else tells me that they'd be very good for the job because they know a lot about racing, which I thought was pretty funny. That really set me thinking that it is not so much wickedness, but it's incompetence often in government and a failure of the independent regulators. Because had the regulator really not been captive to the racing industry, and I'm not insulting the people, they were not very senior public servants. It's very difficult for them because they're such overbearing personalities and important personalities who appeared to have the ear of government. I think a lot of those issues wouldn't have arisen. And Quentin, just reflect upon it. I'm pretty sure it's the same in the Banking Royal Commission. Had the regulators actually been doing their job meticulously, a lot of those things wouldn't have been necessary.
Well, I suppose from all our experience in Australia, we now, I think there's public consciousness about the phenomenon known as regulatory capture, where the regulator is captured by the vested interests of the industries they're meant to be regulating.
That's right.
And and hopefully that's many people working in regulation are very well aware of that, but it still requires constant vigilance and education to make people aware that when they're Dutchess or potentially captured with the political influence as well.
That's true, and one's surely constantly shocked at the socialization, the socializing that occurs between regulators and those they're regulating, going off on fishing trips.
And they can hire them. You know, you leave the regulator and you get a job, a well-paid job in the industry you were meant to be regulating.
But of course, the real and fundamental problem is the underfunding of those institutions. So
Yeah, the resourcing of them. Yeah.
the Auditor General, for example, I have the greatest admiration for that office, but diminished in its funding. So the number of really good reviews that they can do are lessened. The oversight of our public institutions by a highly accomplished regulator is key.
But Margaret, you and I will be denounced as supporters of red tape, or in the case of environmental conservation issues, green tape. It's a very powerful political meme, as they say,
It is.
to stand down regulators or defund the regulators.
Well, of course, that gives open slather, doesn't it, to
Yeah,
all sorts of depredations.
look at Musk and Trump at the moment.
Oh, so
So
they can make money.
inevitably, look, you did the Northern Territory. Tom, I'm trying to get my notes here just to remind me. You did the child protection detention in the Northern Territory.
I
Just
did. I
briefly about
did.
that was a confronting experience.
It was very confronting. I had the great good fortune to have as co-commissioner Mick Gooder, who's a great friend, I'm honoured to say. And we used to say we were joined at the hip because we had similar approaches to policy development and what ought to happen. And he'd had a huge experience in the development of public policy. He was so well connected in Australia, so it was a great honour to be with Mick. You'd go into, he used to take me into the chairman's lounge, Quinton, and people would come up to see him, from ambassadors to ministers. It was wonderful. Yes, it was confronting again when Mr. Turnbull said, as we neared the end of our inquiry and we have that informal meeting, just so there won't be any surprises, he said, "I suppose you're going to ask for a lot of money." And Mick said to him, "Well, Prime Minister, we think there's enough money goes into the Northern Territory. It's just very poorly spent." He was a bit cross about that response. But the Commonwealth did take that attitude. I thought that was very, very obvious. Buckets of money, but they couldn't even tell us what programs they were funding, and they certainly didn't want accountability for their money. When you
And
ask, I was just going to say, when you ask those wonderfully keen young people doing programs for all sorts of not-for-profits in the Northern Territory, funded by the Commonwealth, what their exit strategy was, they looked very puzzled. They didn't think
Yeah.
of themselves as capacity built.
Yes,
Yeah,
yes.
it was still Uncle Tom's Cabot thinking.
I regret to say that's true. Then you're sort of retired or semi-retired. How would you
Well,
describe your I know you're intellectually inquisitive and you're still reading. Are you doing anything in apart from the Centre for Public Integrity, which is what I want to get to now, anything else you're doing? Have you written papers and things to get things off your chest?
I tend not to do that now. I think I had a feeling that I'd probably, well, I had to give some speeches and things like that. And I was involved with the Churchill Trust for many, many years and sort of would do some speeches for them and so on. A wonderful institution, as you know. Last year, I decided at 81, 30th of June, that I would not renew my practicing certificate. That doesn't
Yes.
mean you can't do things, but it was a good way of saying, that's it, you know, really let others do it. And inevitably, one's intellectual powers are dwindling, and it's necessary to get ahead of the game on that, I think. So the last big thing I did was the Royal Commission in the in Papua New Guinea into the UBS loan affair. And that was pretty interesting. That told me that Australia had really dropped the bundle on the ball on PNG. We should have been up there helping in a non, you know, in a disinterested way with their institutions.
In a non-colonial way.
Well, we didn't have a good reputation. Of course, they looked elsewhere in 1974 when they were looking for independence. They looked to African countries. They even had a Canadian, but they didn't have any Australians helping them at all.
And
But
we've still dropped the ball. It sounds like we've still dropped the ball on PNG.
well, that's my feeling. It was very interesting to see, for example, it was during COVID, and so it wasn't easy to come and go. So I went up there for a block of time to see a lot of signs on all the stoby pipes in Mandarin, in Chinese. They're very comfortable about the Chinese being around. Where were we? Well, we sponsored a very nice little art festival. And they were lovely people in the High Commission, but their brief was not encouraging. Not encouraging at all.
So you're now a director of the Centre for Public Integrity, and what motivated you to become involved with the centre after this experience? I mean, you've done your fair share.
Done lots of things. And I've been very privileged to have been offered them, and I tend not to say no. So that's good. Look, I think it was the realization that democracy is not the default position. The democratic institutions that we take for granted is actually pretty unusual in the spectrum of history. We think that it will go on getting better, but as we can see, the trajectory actually is dropping back. So there was perhaps you might call a sort of gilded age after the Second World War, when democratic institutions were emerging, respected, developed. It looks as though they may be slipping back a bit. And it's very important that everyone actually understands this, because democracy means sharing power. And lots of people do not wish to do this. So the natural state of man in society, I think, is actually to slip into autocracy of some form or another. It always has been. And so I'm still raging against the dying of the democratic light.
And
Oh
all
dear,
that
it sounds
wonderful.
so ridiculous, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't sound ridiculous. It's absolutely essential for all of us to understand that and to stand up for a functioning democracy, which includes accountability. Margaret, you've been wonderful. Thanks very much for sharing your life and story with the Centre for Public Integrity. All the best.
Thanks, Quentin. An honour to chat with you.
All right, guys.
You're a beaut. We went too
That was
long.
great.
Oh, we went on and on. I'm sorry, Quentin, but it's very kind. He let me rabbit on.
No. Absolutely vital document now. I think it's very valuable. It'll go into the whether Bill cuts it up a bit or edits it a bit, but the whole thing should go into the National Archive.
Yeah. I didn't know you were from Hamilton in Victoria, Margaret. That's where my family's from.
How is it? Is it? My father was in the Air Force during the war, and he and my mother rented a farmhouse just outside Hamilton. Then he went off up north, as they tended to do. So she went home to her family in country South Australia.
Yes, right.
So it was a mere moment in Hamilton.
Look, it probably hasn't changed since then, so don't worry too much.
I don't know, but the most wonderful fellow from the Tiwi Islands that I met when I was doing that Royal Commission, who had one of those impossible Tiwi names that I don't have on the tip of my tongue. We were chatting. He was a senior jail visitor, and he had lots. He was a wonderful person. Anyway, we were chatting a bit, and how it came about, I don't know. But he went to school from the Tiwi Islands in Hamilton. He said he stayed with a fa he was billeted with a family. He got a scholarship. He's very smart. The family, he said, was so good to him. He had loved them to bits, but he missed the warmth of the Tiwi Islands.
Yeah, what a place to land. It's sort of, I'm not sure you've been there, Quinn. It's like the most Anglo-Saxon part of Australia outside, or in the world outside of the UK. It's sort of this walk back in time.
It's got some of the great public schools there, hasn't
Yeah. Mick, the Labor senator, Indigenous bloke. What's his surname? Oh, God. It's going to hurt my head. Funny place. Well, thank
Okay.
you both so much. I'll edit that and I'll try and get it up probably tomorrow morning, I'd suggest.
Well, there's a lot of chopping to get out of there. I saw an
Oh,
alarm what
no,
the time
it's
was.
pretty good. I think it's,
It was about 50 minutes, wasn't it? 50 minutes.
yeah, a touch less, but yep. I think we'll. I'll read back over the transcript and see what we do. I don't like editing it too much. It's hard to maintain the flow, so I'll just have to see how it looks.
It is in edit. It's very clever, some of the editors, to try to maintain the flow, but it can be done. But I can't think of anything because I was so fascinated with Margaret's insights
Yeah, I was the same.
myself.
Yeah.
So if it, the, I suppose the editorial judgment you have to make, Bill, if it holds the interest, I think all the lawyers from the centre will be fascinated with Margaret's insights too.
Oh, I think so. What a life, Margaret. Amazing.
Well, all about, I think, being offered opportunities, Phil, and saying yes. I mean, I'm not joking when I say that it was just a great deal of good fortune for me.
Yes,
And
but you need the confidence to go
we
with it,
haven't got
Margaret.
equal opportunity. We have an equal opportunity in affirmative action and judicial appointments. So we've got women to men. I know it's all meant to be merit-based, but we've got more women on the bench now than ever before, haven't we?
Well, I certainly know that my appointment was because there was a clear decision that we need to appoint more women, and I probably there weren't that many women at the bar, and I think they probably thought that I'd scrub up, and wouldn't be too awkward.
Sound, you're very sound.
Sound, yes, sound.
In many ways, your early appointment on for the state of Queensland would have helped you in the development of your reputation, because it can be quite vicious amongst the attorneys and about that, from my observation about judicial appointments. That would have helped because I said, well, what I think they make judgments about who do you bloody vote for? And that's what politicians do. Who do they vote for? Well, they're not a Labor voter or they're not a Lib voter. And they make judgments about before that on judicial appointments.
Well, the other thing was that with the Goss government that came in, most of those people had been in my tutorial and lecture classes at UQ because QUT didn't come in till a bit later.
Right.
So I'd known them when they wore shorts and bare feet.
Yeah,
And I'd
yeah.
had, you know, I had cheery classes, and they were nice fellows. Interesting.
Right,
That helps.
good.
Okay.
All
All
right.
right.
Thanks very much indeed, Margaret. It's been wonderful.
Thanks,
Thanks
Quentin.
both of you so much. It's so good. We can't express our gratitude enough to both of you helping out with this. It's awesome.
Thanks, Bill. Have a
Okay.
good day.
All
Are
the best
school
to you, mate.
holidays going all right?
Yes.
Okay.
All good.
Righto.
See you.
Bye.
Bye, guys.